Pine Plains in Millerton, 1-800-553-2234, gmtayloroil.com. Fiesta Bar and Grill, an authentic Mexican restaurant at the heart of Great Barrington in front of the Triplex Theater. Margarita Mondays and Taco Tuesdays, fiestabarandgrill.com. A couple of events coming up on Saturday at the Hotchkiss School. The Tremaine Art Gallery opens up its latest exhibition, Con in Selznick, with a reception on the 25th from 4 until 6 p.m. And then that evening, Michael Mussolami Trio Plus 2 will be performing for free at the Esther Eastman Music Center, Elfers Hall at Hotchkiss School. That begins at 7 p.m., and as we said, that is absolutely free and open to the public. More information, hotchkiss.org/arts. Now, if you're a not-for-profit or public service organization has an event going on that you'd like to publicize, we'd like to help you out, robinhoodradio.com. Click on Contact Us. Click on Submit PSA. Once you're there, make sure you fill out the form completely. After you fill out the form, make sure you click Submit. The only rule we have, it's one very simple rule, and that rule is, as long as you don't pay for it elsewhere, we'll put it on the air absolutely free on Robinhood Radio. Welcome to Off Script with Dan Dwyer on Robinhood Radio, featuring in-depth interviews with guests from the world of theater and allied arts. Underwriting support from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare, collectible, and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th-century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. And now, here's the host of Off Script, Dan Dwyer.
Well, thank you, Marshall. For today's program on Off Script, we'll be departing from theater topics and talk about film from an award-winning filmmaker who lives in Robin Hood Radio's very own listening area. My guest today is Anne Makepeace, and her film, Thousand Pieces of Gold, for which she wrote the original screenplay, has just been re-released in a fully restored format and will be screened at the Movie House in Millerton on Saturday night, Jan 25. Besides her fiction films, Anne has made a number of documentaries on figures as diverse as Eleanor Roosevelt, photographer Robert Capa, which won a Primetime Emmy Award, and architect I.M. Pei. Her first documentary, Baby, It's You, was screened at Sundance Film Festival and selected for the prestigious Whitney Biennial Program. And speaking of prestigious, Anne Makepeace has been a recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship along the way. Welcome, Anne.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I tried to convey in my introduction this incredibly versatile range of storytelling in film that you've made. But before we get into all that, let's talk about Thousand Pieces of Gold, because that's going to be at the Millerton Movie House Saturday night, January 25. You made that back in the 90s. I guess two questions. How did it come about, and how did it come back now?
So I was the screenwriter on the film. I was actually hired to write it by some friends of mine, the director Nancy Kelly and the editor and producer Kenji Yamamoto. Nancy optioned a book that is called Thousand Pieces of Gold, and that book is based on a true story. So the main characters in this film were real people. And so Nancy optioned the book. She put together financing, very difficult to put together financing for an independent feature. This was basically in 1987, 88. I think we filmed in 89. Mm-hmm. And it was financed in large part by American Playhouse, the mm-hmm. wonderful series that no longer exists on PBS. But it aired on American Playhouse, and it was released in theaters.
But it's based on real people, but it's talking about real people in a period of history that Americans don't usually get to hear about. So tell us what that's about.
What's so great about the re-release of this film is that it's very relevant right now. I mean, it's a story of immigration, this racism, Me Too.
What's the premise? The character, the main character.
The main character is a Chinese woman who, as a girl or as a young, very young woman, sold by her starving family in northern China and ends up in a little mining town called Warren's Diggins, Idaho. And she was basically sold to be a prostitute. She wins her freedom. I don't want to give away too much, But Chris Cooper plays the guy who falls madly in love with her. And
who's also in a movie at the movie house this week, Little Women. He plays the rich next-door neighbor.
Yeah, and he is just wonderful. And Roz Chow is wonderful as Lalu, the main character. And she was a real person, and we collapsed time a little bit in the script. I think she actually arrived in San Francisco around 1860, but we collapsed it because in the 1880s, some laws called the Chinese Exclusion Acts were passed. And many Chinese on the West Coast were deported. There was a lot of violence against the Chinese people who, you know, because, you know, stealing jobs and a lot of things that are similar now. And so it's really a story. There's a story of love. It's a story of hope. It's very beautiful. And I can say that because I was the writer. I wasn't the director. So I can't take credit for the beauty of the film. But I saw it for the first time in, I don't know, 20-some years at the movie house a week ago Sunday. And I'm proud of it. I really loved it.
Good. So how did its re-release and its reformatting and its restoration come about?
There's a company called, and I might get this name wrong, it's something like Indie Collective. And it's organized by a woman named Sandra Schulberg with the goal of saving a lot of films, independent films, from the dustbin, from, you know, deteriorating. And so she's done quite a few films, and she and Nancy Kelly hooked up and decided to do that with this film. I think in large part for a re-release, but also to preserve it for history.
Yeah. If people can't get to the Milita Movie House, and I hope they do, can they stream it on any of the platforms?
I don't believe it's available for streaming yet.
Okay.
It probably will be, but I know the distributor, Kino Lorber, is hoping for a theatrical release before streaming goes out.
That's great.
So I would say to people, if you can't get there, just keep Googling Thousand Pieces of Gold and see, or go on Kino Lorber's website.
In case you're just joining us, the program is Off Script. I'm your host, Dan Dwyer. My guest today is Anne Makepeace. She lives in the Robin Hood Radio listening area, and she's has decades of filmmaking experience, both in fiction and documentary filmmaking. There's a lot of films that you've done since Thousand Pieces of Gold that I'd like to ask about, but let's jump right to the present. What are you working on now?
I'm working on a very local project that I'm excited about. I'm actually doing a short film about our first responders here in the northwest corner. And the goal of the film is basically to introduce, you know, who are these people who save your life when you need it? And, you know, especially weekenders don't really know who they are. And so it's to show, you know, who they are, why they do it, and the range of jobs they have in their normal life. You know, anything from teachers to electricians, plumbers, you know, who do this without pay. You know, the Salisbury Ambulance Squad and the Lakeville Hose Company are more the focus because that's where I live. But we're also filming with other in other towns.
There's a big pressure for some of the towns in the face of not being able to get ample supplies of volunteers to basically subcontract to private firms for this now, isn't there?
So far, Salisbury hasn't had to do that. Some towns have, but so far, you know, there are enough, but it's like the population of Salisbury, it's an aging population. So we need people to sign up. We need young recruits.
What triggered your interest in this? I mean, we're all interested in it because we rely on Salisbury Ambulance Squad when there's an emergency. But why make a movie about it?
Actually, I was asked to make it by Mary and Philip Oppenheimer, who are...
Mary Close, of course.
Yes,
Mary
Close, yes. And she's the driving force behind, you know, getting the funding and everything. And this is... I haven't actually made a short film, I don't know, for decades, because most of my films, or all my films, are feature-length documentaries. So this is a bit of a challenge, and we have our last shoot on in a week, where we're going to shoot a simulation of a car accident, not the accident itself, but somebody being taken out of a car by the jaws of life. So that'll be really great, and that'll be our last shoot. So I'm deep in editing right now.
Good. How long will it be, roughly?
It's growing, I think. Probably about 15 minutes, mm-hmm. and, you know, we'll put it up on the web. We'll get it shown at schools. We'll have some screenings. We'll have screenings for the people who have participated, and then we'll have wider screenings probably at the movie house, various libraries.
Right. Is this a generic appeal for volunteer squads, or is it specific to a fundraising device for Salisbury Ambulance?
I don't do fundraisers.
Okay.
I do human documentaries. Mm-hmm. It's the people that move me. So what's the purpose of it? It's an introduction. I think it's, you know, for Marion Phillip, the idea, you know, she's worked so hard on affordable housing, mm-hmm. and this is not unrelated to that,
right.
because a lot of these people who are volunteering can't really or have a hard time affording to live in Lakeville or Salisbury,
right.
or some of the other towns around. So, Sharon, you know, my purpose is telling a human story. This is who these people are, and they're really cool, and it would be, you know, a cool thing to volunteer.
Right. So we started talking about 1,000 Pieces of Gold, which is one of your first screenplay efforts way back when, and then we're talking of what you're doing now. You've done a lot in between. Let's go back again. Your films tell stories, whether they're fiction or fact. Why did you go into filmmaking as a way to tell stories?
I've always been a storyteller, for better or for worse, you know, since I was a little kid. I graduated from college as an English major with very little idea of what to do with it. And so I became an English teacher. I taught 8th grade English. This is in Woodside, California, which is next to Stanford, where I went to college. And it was a public school, but it was a very progressive public school. And so I was able to teach a lot of electives. Like I taught songwriting and drama and filmmaking. And I didn't know anything about filmmaking. I just got a Super 8 camera and we just started making films and I just loved it. I just absolutely loved it. So I started teaching filmmaking classes for kids in the summer. And then we were shooting a scene at Great America in San Jose one day and I thought, I want to do this. They're having all the fun. I want to do this. So I took a year off from teaching. I went to film school also at Stanford. Came out of film school with an hour-long dramatic film about the Moonies, which was...
Was that Moonchild?
Yeah.
Yeah. I saw that on your website.
Yeah.
Which Moonchild. Is on MakePeace.com. Can we say that?
Yeah, MakePeaceProductions.com.
MakePeaceProductions.com. Okay.
Yeah. And yeah, actually, here's some shameless self-promotion, but you can stream Moonchild and six other films of mine on my website, through my website.
So what was there about the Moonies that said, aha, that's going to be my first documentary?
I kept hearing stories. Now, this is back in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
I kept hearing stories about a family that a friend of mine knew whose daughter had gone into the Moonies. Her brother tried to get her out and ended up staying for a year and basically being brainwashed along with her. The family hired people called deprogrammers to kidnap her. And she tried to commit suicide during this deprogramming because she had been brainwashed into thinking it was better to die than to come out into the sinful, horrible world that we live in. So I was really fascinated by really how the brother became, and when he knew, you know, he'd gone to see Reverend, so-called Reverend Moon, you know, who talks like Hitler or used to, and nevertheless joined. So I guess what drew me to it is, you know, the vulnerability we all have, the susceptibility we have, the loneliness, you know, because the people who joined were people who, you know, whose partner had broken up with them, or they just graduated from college or from high school and they didn't know what to do with their lives. And suddenly there's definition and there's, you know, a family. It's a fake family, but... And I guess I was just moved by, as research, I met a lot of people who had been in the Moonies and were out. And actually, there's six ex-Moonies in my film, including the main character. And so I don't want to take up all your time with Moonchild, but that was my first film, my thesis film in film school. And I sold it amazingly all over the world, and I was able to quit teaching and become a full-time filmmaker. But I had no interest in becoming a documentary filmmaker. Moonchild is a drama, mm-hmm. right? And so, you know, I wrote my first screenplay. I was invited to the Sundance Lab. I had Winona Ryder. I had it all set up. And for 5 years, I tried to get it made, and it just broke my heart. I never did get it made. But while during that period, I was writing for other people. So that's how Thousand Pieces of Gold came to be, because I was, you know, my friends, the director, they really liked my writing. They really liked me. So that's how that, it was a job.
Sure.
But a job that I fell in love with. I can't do films unless I'm in love with either a character or something.
So let's talk about the three documentaries then, about figures that everybody knows. Eleanor Roosevelt, E.M. Pei, and Robert Capa. Why?
And Edward Curtis.
Edward missed that one. The famous American photographer, 19th century, of the American West.
Of Native Americans,
right,
yeah.
Native Americans.
Early 20th century,
yeah.
Actually.
What made you fall in love with those four characters?
How much time do you have?
Well, let's talk about Eleanor Roosevelt, because, you know, FDR is my political hero, and you can't really, I don't think, regard FDR as a political hero without acknowledging the equal, particularly with the historical frame of reference, the equal import of his wife.
Eleanor Roosevelt is a real hero to me. Now, that's another film that was a commission. Most of my films, I start from scratch, I get an idea, I start writing grant proposals, and they take 3 or 4 years to make. This one was actually the National Park Service over at Valkill, the museum in Hyde Park, which is her former house.
It's amazing.
It's a beautiful.
For anyone who's never been over there, because it's just a short drive from anyone in the listening area of Robin Hood Radio, describe where how she retreated and what her retreat there is like.
Well, it's a cottage.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful little cottage. You know, it's not even on the same grounds as the big FDR.
It's across the road, as I recall, right?
It's only like a mile away.
Yeah.
You know, just to get out of the limelight, I guess, she moved there. And then she basically lived there with women friends for, you know, most of her later life after her kids were born. So
While the president was alive. Still.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah. So that was a commission of the films that you mentioned. Actually, it's interesting. I hadn't thought of this, but the I.M. Pei film was actually a directing work for hire. The Robert Capa film was a commission from American Masters at WNET. So, but the Coming to Light, my film about Edward Curtis, who many of you would know as the photographer of Native Americans. He photographed Geronimo, Chief Joseph, and I fell in love with his story. It's a long story. I won't go into it, but that actually is my favorite of all my films so far, because it really took my heart. And
why did it take your heart?
Because,
I mean, I know you adore Eleanor Roosevelt. I can
see
that in the
totally
expression in your face,
and
it's coming through in your voice too.
Yeah.
But what's so special about Edward Curtis?
So, what I decided to do in the making of that film was go to the Native communities, reservations where he photographed, and find descendants of the people he photographed and ask them, you know, what's going on in this picture? Who was this person? So I went to 10 reservations all over the West, Navajo, Hopi, Crow, you know, 10, from Alaska to southern Arizona. And the people, you know, I just fell in love with the people. And I would go around like a Jehovah's Witness with my big book of Curtis photographs, you know, showing them to people. And they would say, oh, yeah, why don't you go talk to Elsie over, she lives over that way, you know. And so I got to, and then that project was the longest for me. That was a 10-year project.
Well, you started doing these interviews as research, and then you brought the cameras back to record some of these people.
Yeah, that is a really interesting story, because originally, because this was still, when I started this, still in the era when I was still wanting to direct narrative feature films. And so I envisioned this film about Edward Curtis as a biopic, basically, dramatic picture. And I had Ed, famous actor, married to Amy,
Oh, Ed Harris.
Yes, thank you. Ed Harris was...
Now on Broadway in To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah. So he was on board to play Curtis. And I got some funding from the NEH to develop a script. And with that funding, I went out to the Hopi Reservation because Curtis, I kind of was focusing on the Hopi Reservation because he went out there every year for almost 20 years in a row photographing, and he formed relationships with people. So I knew there would be stories. So I went out there, and that was where I fell in love with, you know, I was frustrated in trying to get funding for the biopic, but I began to think, isn't the story what Native life is like now and what these pictures mean to people? Because when I'm taking a picture and somebody, you know, in their 80s says, that's my mother, and starts telling me stories about her mother, suddenly these pictures had a whole new meaning for me. You know, they're not just works of art, they're people. You know, and there's a lot going on outside the frame of those pictures. Because when Curtis was photographing, it was a time of forced assimilation where the U.S. government was taking Native American kids forcibly sometimes, putting them in boarding schools, forbidding them from teaching their languages, forbidding any ceremonies. Many ceremonies were outlawed. So Curtis was trying to show what life had been like before all this pressure was going on. So he would...
So his vision was more romantic than documentary, even?
Yes. I would say it would not... I wouldn't use the word romantic. His goal was to show the beauty in Indian life.
But not necessarily the cold reality.
It wasn't like, you know, Jacob Riis pictures of dead horses in the streets of New York, which was contemporary with Curtis.
Right.
But... He did photograph, you know, real ceremonies that were really going on. But when he did portraits, he would ask people, you know, would you put on your traditional dress? And there's a scene in the film where this Hopi I interviewed, whose grandmother is in one of the pictures, said, you know, her grandmother told her, we would never grind corn in our wedding outfits, you know. So he set some things up. But I was very moved by his story because he basically sacrificed his health, his family, his finances. He started out as a very successful photographer in Seattle. He photographed Teddy Roosevelt's family. That's how he kind of got funding from J.P. Morgan, but then ended up giving up his very lucrative photography practice in Seattle and leaving it to his wife and just devoting his life. And he went to, I think, 80 different tribes across the West. So I was moved by that. And my journey in making the film was kind of a mini Curtis because I was struggling for funding. I was jeopardizing my marriage. I was, you know, it was, there were a lot of parallels in making Coming to Light with the monumental work that Curtis created.
In case you're joining us, my guest is Anne Makepeace, the program's off script. I'm your host, Dan Dwyer. Anne's talking about her career in filmmaking, both in narrative fiction features and in documentaries. And one of her first movies, which is a piece of narrative fiction, that is Thousand Pieces of Gold, which you can see at the Millerton Movie House Saturday evening, January 25th. I don't know where I remember this expression. I think it comes out of the news television business. But it's the camera doesn't lie. Yeah. And my question is, you spent a lot of time writing, trying to find the truth in fiction. You've spent a lot of time documenting people of different kinds of backgrounds. We're in an age where there's more propaganda in word and image than we're used to. Do you think it's still true that the camera doesn't lie?
Well, I don't think it was ever true that the camera doesn't lie. There is always a consciousness behind the camera that is choosing what to frame. You know, I mean, do you frame this beautiful ceremony that's going on, or do you turn it to, kids in modern dress playing? You know, I'm talking about Curtis. Robert Capa, whose famous picture, the Falling Soldier in the Spanish Civil War, has been accused of staging that. But I know that he didn't from letters and stuff. But I would say that captured the truth. But I mean, in any image that's created, somebody is making choices, and somebody is framing out other things. So it can't ever tell the whole truth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the films that I do, I try to tell the kernel of truth that moved me in the first place. And in documentaries, you have to stick to the truth. But at the same time, you come back, like with Tribal Justice, my most recent documentary, you come back with like 300 hours of footage. So you are shaping a story. And, you know, my background as an English major and my work in narrative features all has gone into the making of my documentaries, because documentaries have to be stories. So when you're shaping something as a story, again, you're leaving a lot out. You're focusing on certain aspects of a person's life or character. So you can't ever tell the whole truth.
You mentioned your new project, besides the ambulance squad, Volunteer Ambulance Squad, Tribal Justice. Did that come out of the Curtis experience? And tell us more about this Tribal Justice.
So I've always, since I was a kid, been fascinated with Native American subjects. A lot of people think my name is Native American, but it's not. It's an old Puritan English name. So I guess four or five of my films are about Native subjects. So I was drawn to the Curtis story because of my longtime interest in Native subjects. I think Tribal Justice came to me because somebody saw that my previous film, We Still Live Here, which is about the Wampanoags on Cape Cod bringing back their language. By the way, 2020 is the 400th anniversary of the arrival of the Mayflower, and it was the Wampanoags who greeted the Pilgrims and then lived to regret it. But at any rate, that's what led to Tribal Justice. So somebody saw that I did it, that they liked what I did with a Native story. And, you know, it's a whole different thing going into Indigenous communities to make a film. You know, there's a lot of trust issues that one has to, you know, overcome. To me, it's always really rich to go into these communities. I mean, my films are almost all about cross-cultural stories, including Thousand Pieces of Gold, including Tribal Justice, We Still Live Here, Rain in a Dry Land, my film about Somali refugees resettling in America. That was a whole other culture. So, making films, whether they're narrative or documentary, it's a journey. It's a journey that starts out with some kind of love for me and then has to be shaped into a story.
You've been at it for, can we say 3 decades now, pretty
much? At least,
okay. When you started out, you worked, I gather, in film, and now everybody's right in digital. What's the difference?
Yeah, when I went to film school, we worked in 16mm,
yeah.
And I miss it. I miss the tactile nature of handling film. So Moonchild and Coming to Light was digital. So I guess Moonchild's the only feature-length film I've made shooting in 16mm, other than my other student films. But so digital cameras came out in around the early 90s, 1993, 94, or at least affordable digital cameras. So when I made Baby It's You, I was in that frustrating period of trying to get my first screenplay made. And also my husband and I had decided to try to get pregnant through in vitro because it hadn't been working the fun way. And so I was in this very frustrating period of my professional life, and my husband, my then husband, said, why don't you just get one of these digital cameras and make a film about, he said, what you're going through, which I think is very telling since we were going through it together. But at any rate, that was the beginning of documentary. My first reaction was, I don't do documentaries. Why would I do that? And then, and also, who would want to watch this? You know, who would want to watch somebody going through fertility stuff? But then I began to think about the wider story. You know, my extremely eccentric New England, Connecticut, Yankee family. And the fact also that with six of us in our generation, between my then husband's family and ours, all in our 40s, none of us had kids except for my husband's sister's lesbian lover's sperm bank baby.
Okay.
So that was the only child in the next generation. So I'm looking at, why is this? So it was really it became an exploration of family. There's also an abortion story in it.
And this led to which project is this now?
So this is Baby, It's You.
Baby, It's You.
So this is a very personal documentary. I would never do another personal documentary. I like to be behind the camera. But it did
And you made this in 1993?
No. I got the camera. I started shooting in 95 or 96, finished it in 97, premiered at Sundance January 98. And then was on POV, I guess, later that year.
But still, we take some of the topics that you've mentioned now about, you know, artificial insemination, about lesbian couples and all that kind of stuff is taken for granted. In the 90s, that was rather cutting edge.
Very.
Very. Yeah.
Yeah. It was very cutting edge. But that was my first experience with digital. Mm-hmm. We shot it on a Sony VX700, I think, or I sort of forgot. It's a long time ago. It put me on the map as a documentary filmmaker, and it also was kind of like putting on shoes that fit. This is how I'm supposed to tell stories. Right. And people who had been saying to me for years, why don't you make the Curtis film as a documentary? And I would say, I'm not a documentary filmmaker. I'm not going to make it. And then I suddenly realized, wouldn't that be a lot better as a documentary?
Right.
And it is. So that was my beginning as a documentary filmmaker.
We used to call them in the old days outlets. Now they all call them platforms. Do you think it's easier for people to make movies with it because there are more platforms now?
I don't know. There's such a glut now. I mean, the good news is that the means of production are available and outlets are available. But you still have to be good.
Yeah. Quality's it. And we're going to have to end it on that happy note. Okay. The quality filmmaking that you can see at the movie house in Millerton on 25 is a movie called 1,000 Pieces of Gold, written by Ann Makepeace, who's been my guest today on Off Script. Thank you, Ann, for coming in.
Okay.
And thank you all for listening. If you like what you heard, go to the robinhoodradio.com website, go to the donate page, and express your appreciation. Thanks for listening. Until the next time, be well.
Thank you, Dan.
Underwriting support for Off Script with Dan Dwyer from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare, collectible, and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th-century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. Off Script with Dan Dwyer is also available via podcast on our on-demand page, robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand, and then click on Off Script with Dan Dwyer.